You're listening to episode 328 of the UAV Digest. I'm Max Flight in Hartford, Connecticut.
And I'm David Vanderhoof in Fort Washington, Pennsylvania. Hello, Max. How are we this week?
I'm good. Today, you're the birthday boy, though, so hopefully you're doing really well with that.
Well, I'm recording UAV Digest, so that's a good thing. I'm quarantined by myself, so we're going to have to figure out a way of celebrating. I don't know. Maybe I'll play with some Legos today. Made some cinnamon rolls this morning, and I'm just going to make it a little better than every other day that sort of occurs anymore in this time distorted universe. But we've got stories to talk about, and when you hear these, it'll be over and done with. My life. So let's get into blockchain and black boxes. Thought that was kind of spooky. Drone cinematographers and labor agreements. Fly like a dragonfly. A virtual recon drone. AI and virtual controllers. And AUVSI webinars. So Max, we got a bit of a story there. Should we get started?
Let's get started, David.
Well, our first story comes from the U.S. Transportation Department. It says blockchain could bring more trust to commercial drones. This is from Coindesk.com. In a report titled Blockchain for Unmanned Aircraft, the U.S. Department of Transportation says blockchain could help in areas with large numbers of drone operations. So blockchain is one of those things that keep sitting on the periphery of drones, Max. What do you think?
Yes, we haven't heard much about it lately, it seems, but this is back with this DOT report. And they're looking at using blockchain particularly, or the advantages of using blockchain perhaps, particularly around certain high-risk areas or areas where there are many, many drone flights. And the blockchain technology, the DOT says, is being looked on to deliver a framework that can be used by stakeholders in the commercial drone industry. They say it can ensure security and provide for identity management, as well as providing a support role in aircraft traffic management, UAS conflict management, and flight authorization.
Which is simply put, UAS ID. It's a way of encouraging ID for the UAS or UTM.
At its base, yes. And what they're considering here is a flight recorder that utilizes blockchain technology. And that way, it could provide investigators with flight information that was collected prior to some accident or incident. It would also potentially let law enforcement proactively monitor flights in real time. That's an interesting one.
Provide data to industry regulators so they could optimize drone routes. Provide data to insurance companies. I found that one interesting. And provide data to pilots to ensure compliance to regulations. To go back to the provide data to insurance companies, for anybody here in the United States who has a television on, has seen things like Progressive and Allstate have these new receivers you plug in your car and they give you a discount because your safe driving skills, and it sends a real-time information to your phone, and that also provides that information to your insurance company. So if you are stopping at red lights and are driving the speed limit, you become less of a risk and the insurance company knows it and gives you a discount. So this would definitely be a way for insurance companies to monitor and be able to provide reasonable rates and develop, I guess what we really haven't developed yet, which is a model of what a safe drone operation is. So I do, from an insurance standpoint, I do sort of agree with this, that, you know, it definitely an advantage. But I guess, Max, the one that's really interesting is the real-time information to the law enforcement. I'm wondering how the law enforcement gets access to that blockchain.
Yeah, it obviously assumes some kind of transmission of the information, of the data, if it's real time. And I'm not sure how that would operate exactly. But blockchain is at its core is a relatively simple concept. I mean, you may, if you're not familiar with it, you may have heard it described this way, but it's characterized as a distributed ledger, which means that the data actually exists in multiple places, and there's a mechanism built into it to ensure the integrity of the data. So what that means from a practical standpoint is that you can rely on the data. It can't be altered without it breaking the chain, basically, and you know that. So when you're talking about things like medical deliveries, for example, that's one of the examples they use in this report, transporting organs for transplant and having data that's accurate and reliable is something, I guess, that blockchain technology could help ensure. So the DOT report, at the end of it, there's an appendix, how blockchains actually work. So if you'd like to read what really amounts to a kind of a nicely done, fairly summary. Understandable, yeah, summary of how blockchains work, you can take a look at that. And of course, we'll have that that link in the show notes.
Here's to the DOT for writing out a document that's legible and intelligible for the general public. I was appreciative of that because I'm a historian, not a computer programmer. But let's talk about the Cinematographers Guild. Sounds like something from Dune. The Cinematographers Guild celebrates drone victory over Warner Brothers in arbitration. The International Cinematographers Guild initiated arbitration against Warner Brothers.
Yeah, they said drone operators that were filming for productions are covered under the labor agreement, and that those who worked in, quote, all phases of motion and still picture photography, which would include members of a drone crew, should be treated the same as aerial directors of photography, as camera operators, and camera technicians. And of course, all of those groups are covered under labor agreements that ensure that they get certain health benefits and pension benefits. So the Cinematographers Guild argued that these folks operating drones for video purposes in their productions should also be covered. Of course, Warner Brothers looked at it a little differently.
Yeah, they took it as a drone operator is the same as a helicopter pilot. They're a subcontractor or an independent contractor. So all independent contractors are not held accountable like someone from a photography guild, right? And if they were employees, then Warner Brothers would be considered by the FAA as an unlicensed drone operator. I thought that was a very clever way of handling the situation. Well, they're not our responsibility, because if they were, the FAA would be breathing down our necks.
Right. And this particular arbitration, it's specific. It's not a general case. This related to the drone technicians that were hired for the Rush Hour TV series that was filmed in 2015. So it actually goes back 5 years. But it went to arbitration, and the arbiter sided with the Cinematographers Guild.
Yeah, Warner Brothers should have covered five members of the drone crews under the terms of the guild's basic agreement. One drone pilot was not covered. He piloted the drone while another operator worked the camera and did not exercise artistic skill. I thought that was interesting. That's still sort of the helicopter argument, which says the pilot isn't responsible for the technology, but the camera operator in the back is. An interesting way of spinning it from the arbiter standpoint, but evidently not everybody in that group was flying and operating the cameras, etc.
So the article points out that this doesn't necessarily set a firm precedent. So we may see this and hear about this kind of thing in the future. But the Guild did say that the arbitrator found that the employer had the burden of proof that it was subcontracting for work that was not covered by the basic agreement, and that Warner Brothers did not meet that standard. So that may be another avenue for an argument in the future as to whether or not these folks operating drones and operating the cameras, exercising creative content, whether or not they fall under the collective bargaining agreement. And it kind of sounds like, in a way, like they do. I mean, what's the difference between an operator of a camera that's happens to be sitting on a tripod and the operator of a camera that happens to be slung underneath a drone, you know?
Well, the camera operators are one thing, but, you know, I get the sort of argument about the drone operator. I mean, the camera operator is a cinematographer. The drone operator is a pilot.
Unless the drone operator is also operating the camera.
I would hope these kind of environments, it would be that they would be flying two man. So I think basically that's the way it should be. But I guess we'll see. It's interesting. How do you divide up the work?
We'll see this issue being revisited in the future because the implications are kind of significant. And that one that Warner Brothers made about who's the drone operator, who's licensed, whether it's an independent contractor, that takes you down one path. That's where they would like to go. But if that's an employee, then the employee isn't responsible for the for the license to operate. The company would be in that case. So that presents something.
And the company would also be responsible for any liabilities. Yeah. So, yeah. But let's talk about insects. Stealthy little drones that fly like insects. This is from BBC. Animal Dynamics is a technology startup that takes lessons from wildlife and applies them to drone design. Yes, Max and I like taking animals and making them into drones. This is another one of those stories, but these are tiny little bugs.
Yeah, yeah. So this concept is also sometimes referred to as biomechanics. And what Animal Dynamics has been working on is something called the Skeeter, which is actually sort of modeled after a dragonfly, and that it uses flapping wings to power this little Skeeter hand-launched drone. One of the features of dragonflies is they're able to navigate well, fly well in very windy conditions. And as we know, most drones don't do so well in extremely windy conditions. So this is an attempt to take some of those qualities of the dragonfly and apply them to a little drone.
Yeah, and this is an update from 2 years ago, actually, in episode 262. And they're now able to operate in gusts over 20 knots, which is 23 miles per hour or 37 kilometers an hour, which is pretty impressive, but it's a tiny aircraft. So, I mean, I guess we'll have to see if they can scale this up, but 23 miles an hour is kind of the wind we're having at my place today. The house is starting to shake in some of these gusts. I can see having the technology to fly through this weather is a good thing. And besides, I like ornithopters, and continue with my dune metaphor. You know, I like things with flapping wings. So this is really cool. And it's very simple. They're using smartphone electronics. So we'll keep following it. In another 2 years, Max and I will talk about this again, and they will have gone up to like 50 kilometers an hour or 50 knots. And then we can talk about hurricanes.
Yeah, smartphone electronics, the miniaturization of GPS and accelerometers and all of the things that you find in a smartphone is really what's allowed the drone industry, especially the consumer drone industry, to exist. That miniaturization, of course, is just critical to being able to construct a drone that is light enough, but has all of these features, these sensors, these capabilities. So, yeah, without Without that smartphone stuff, we wouldn't have a DJI Phantom, I don't think.
Ah, smartphones. Interesting technology. The next story comes from geospatialworld.net. AeroVironment unveils fully automated hybrid vertical takeoff and landing unmanned aircraft system. So the Quantex Recon is a lightweight and rapidly deployable reconnaissance solution that's fully automated.
A lot of sensors on it. It's got high resolution, geo-referenced terrain, vegetation, and infrastructure imagery. And it has the ability to provide ground forces with on-demand intelligence, very quickly deployed, very high-quality intelligence available quickly.
But what makes it special? It's a vertical takeoff and landing design, or VTOL, and it transitions to a fixed-wing unmanned aircraft. Can survey up to 0.6 square miles or 12.5 linear miles with a 45-minute flight time. So it's vertical takeoff and landing and quick because it converts over to a fixed wing. And, you know, we're always looking for that blend of the two.
And AeroVironment says that it does not rely on radio signals during flight. So that means the Quantex Recon has greater stealth capability, which, of course, is important for concealed operations. But it's also unaffected by RF jammers, which gives great protection for frontline troops while they're deploying this. So this is clearly a military application for this. But, you know, I was thinking about this a little bit, David, and it sort of occurs to me that when you look at the commercial applications for smaller drones, we always talk about how DJI has the lion's share of that market wrapped up, and it's really difficult to compete with consumer drones these days. And I'm wondering if the military applications, while certainly more complex and costly, are where we're going to see domestic drone companies develop, because that's a market that they can get into and currently a market that the Chinese have difficulty participating in. So, I mean, we sometimes hope for a resurgence or the development of a U.S. drone industry. Maybe that's going to center around military applications.
Which is really how the U.S. drone industry started. And it never seemed to translate into the civilian market. By the time they were getting ready to go into the civilian market, DJI had penetrated it so deeply that it was kind of pointless.
Yeah, game over.
Yeah, they had won before we had even started. But there seems to be an ebb and a flow to this dynamic between civilian technologies and military technologies, where it's going from one to another and back and forth. And like I've said about, you know, for every drone, there's an equal and opposite anti-drone system. You know, the military and civilian are the same way. We've spent hours talking about flying cars and flying taxis. And here the United States Air Force put a requisition in looking for purchasing of 60 of those rapid transit things, where they're adapting the civilian technology to the military. So there's an ebb and flow. And yeah, I guess in the United States, the drone industry is going to, for a long time, be geared towards military, and that's the technology. Though it'll be interesting, Max, to see what happens when we get a very firm UTM and the regulations, and whether the Chinese companies will be able to compete in a way to be able to fly their aircraft in our airspace.
I think that does remain sort of the opportunity for U.S.-based companies to play the major role. It might be different if the Chinese had an automotive industry presence in the United States. That kind of could have been an entry point for it, but they don't. So it's you know, it's hard to see them participating in a big way in the urban air mobility market. But, you know, we'll see. Certainly, a lot of other companies and countries are interested. Toyota, for example, and other auto manufacturers see this as maybe an evolution of the business that they're in. But it might be a little difficult for the Chinese to get a toehold in that market.
We shall see. Since we were talking about a vertical takeoff and landing drone that was a fixed wing in the last story, let's talk about coupling disruptive mechanisms to reshape UAV industry, or hybrid drones. And this is from the MIT Computer Science and Artificial Intelligence Lab, or CSAIL.
CSAIL, along with Dartmouth and the University of Washington, have been working on an AI-based system that uses what they call reinforcement learning to train this model. The reason they're taking a little different approach is because commonly in artificial intelligence, things are developed using computer simulations, but that's different than real-world scenarios. So this reinforcement learning-based AI system allows a drone controller to reduce the discrepancies between the simulations and real-world scenarios, and the controller can adapt its output in order to compensate, which sounds pretty complicated, David, and it probably is.
It's sort of capturing the interesting aspect of vertical takeoff flight. And that's the most complicated transition of all is the transition from vertical flight to horizontal flight. So it's not necessarily an easy problem. I know it's a complicated solution, but it's not an easy problem to work with. Vertical flight has been a challenge forever. Helicopter is lots and lots of compromises held together with one screw just slightly above the engine that keeps everything going, you know, and any of the aircraft that you've seen, you know, the success of Harriers or the F-35B, I mean, that transition is from vertical takeoff to forward movement, and more importantly, from forward movement to vertical landing is a very complex, nuanced transition. And trying to make it autonomous is a completely different thing. You know, with a Harrier pilot, he had one lever by, you know, and the throttle and the switch to rotate the nozzles. In the F-35, it's simplified because it is computer assisted, but there is nothing that goes from hover to flight or flight to hover autonomously, which is really what we're talking about for this.
So what they've developed here happens to work with something that's called OnShape, which is a pretty popular CAD software, computer aided design software. And it uses both simulation and analysis tools, but using this this AI they developed with OnShape lets users create their own hybrid drone designs, their own VTOL drone designs. Now, they still have a lot of work to do. The system, it currently only supports simple flight, and the researchers here are planning to investigate ways that they can strengthen the system so that it can compute much more complex movement. But, I mean, this is pretty pretty fascinating stuff in that the result of all this is to use a piece of design software that a lot of people can use, and you can design your own what they call hybrid drone or VTOL drone.
And with that, you can test fly it, you know, and do all of the dynamics ahead of production. So, I mean, you get the parameters set up and you get the flight tested, and it's a benefit to everybody. So this is one of those systems that you're going to see come out over time where people are going to be able to access it and speed up the design process. The system can figure out quickly that, no, this is not going to work. You're not wasting time on programs where you're having a high risk, little reward. So good for that. Well, last but not least, Our friends at AUVSI launches UAS webinars. This came out as because of the postponed Exponential 2020, which is tentatively scheduled for August 10th through 12th. But they are offering webinars starting May 4th.
Yeah, five webinars. So even though the Exponential event is going to be later in the year, you don't have to wait to get your fix. And five webinars, and they include digital twins, the future of virtual and mixed reality robotic avatars. Another one is drone delivery supporting public health. Also, NASA's vision and role to enable urban air mobility. And David, a couple of others.
Yeah, advancing autonomy through DARPA challenge to benefit first responders. Well, we've talked about that. And aerial connectivity, joint activity, bridging the gap between cellular and aviation, which is a big deal. That's UTM and ID. I kind of want to do the NASA's vision and role to enable urban air mobility. That one really caught my eye, and I went, I'm going to see if I'm available for that.
Yeah, I agree, David. That's kind of my favorite from the bunch. But I'm also interested in that aerial connectivity one, the fifth webinar, the gap between cellular and aviation. I'm curious to see what that is. But we'll have a link to the Drone Life article that mentions these. It has links to each of those webinar sites. So you can follow that in order to learn more about when and how to participate in these webinars. So you'll find that in the show notes, of course, as well as links to all of the stories that we talk about this week. It's all at the UAVdigest.com. And if you want to go straight to the show notes for this episode, that's just simply the UAVdigest.com/328.
And of course, you can find us on multiple channels. Where we'd love to see you is on our Slack listener team. You can send us an email to feedback@theuavdigest.com. We'll send you an invite and you can join the conversation. It keeps growing and growing. The best thing that happened to our Slack teams has been this pandemic, but everybody seems to be enjoying themselves and contributing and coming away with stuff to talk about, and they're not aggravating their spouses by geeking out. Also, if we're going to have maybe our cocktails with the geeks, we will start posting them on our Slack listener team so you can join in and have some conversation there. You can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/theUAVDigest. And of course, you can find us on Twitter at UAVDigest. We didn't post it in the show notes, but if you hear this recording and you scroll back, you can see a gentleman being shaved by a drone on video on our Twitter feed. And I'll leave that at that, and you can try to figure it out. But not sure I would want to do that, Max, even though I desperately need a haircut because of this.
Yeah, we're all getting a little bit bushy here, I think. But to have a drone with some hair clippers suspended underneath it working on my head, I'm not sure I'd go for that. But it is kind of a novel approach, and I think people are just getting a little bit bored maybe and trying to think of interesting things to do, and this is certainly different.
With that, I'm going to say this is David in Fort Washington.
And Max in Hartford.
Stay safe, everyone. Stay home, and thank you for listening.